The majority of the organized religion in the state that made any kind of a statement on Amendment 2 was against Amendment 2. The primary spokesman, one of the primary spokesmen for our opposition, was Rabbi Stephen Foster. Down there towards the end, the newspapers were pumping out this article, 300 churches oppose Amendment 2. It was interesting because they were saying, oh, you guys are the religious right. We'd say, we haven't said anything at all about religion, but look at this, 300 churches oppose Amendment 2. Somehow that got lost on them. But nevertheless, it was quite clear. The harder we tried to get pastors involved and upfront and open, the more they kind of withdrew from us. Okay? But we later learned they were teaching in their churches, they were talking to their people. And there was a combination of our grassroots that was going to the people through our area leaders and through our grassroots organization that were coming up this way from the bottom towards the pastors. And then we were very gently, and I emphasize gently, just giving them, the pastors, a few stuff up here. But they kind of met in the middle. The pastor would go out, teach on the issue, and he'd find out that there was a lot of petition carriers in his church. And there was already somebody there in his church working on this issue. All right, and it made it very comfortable for him to continue to teach on the subject because he wasn't taking sides. His people were already doing it. During the petition drive, we organized a statewide seminar tour. And on my second portion after Mark is entitled Teaching the Grassroots. I'm going to give you the presentation that we gave to our grassroots organizers around the state to teach them the philosophical point of view. We gave them the intellectual reason for voting the way they feel. And I'm going to teach you the seminar that we taught them. But that was a seminar tour we did around the state. That was time-consuming, and it wasn't very inexpensive from a state of expenses, but it circumvented the media. And even if you went into a community that you only had 10 or 15 or 20 people show up there, you still circumvented the media, and the information you got out went out of there. And what we found was, when we came back out of there, the quality of the letters to the editor and everything went up in that area. The goals of those seminars were to do two things. Get speakers that could speak to the issue there locally, and get people who would write good letters to the editor. Quite frankly, it was unsuccessful in getting speakers for a number of reasons. One, the issue was pretty complicated, and it gets pretty complex, and you can, you know, teach somebody a line of logic about this far, but as soon as somebody gives them one step further, they don't know where to go, and they're back on the phone and say, how do you answer that? So the speakers had a difficult time with that, but the letters to the editors greatly improved. We saw a marked improvement in that. We had a lot of speaking opportunities throughout the entire time. Primarily, Will Perkins and I were the ones that covered most of the speaking opportunities around the state. I would suggest we tried to develop a speakers bureau. And again, we ran into the problem that this is a pretty complex issue. And it was difficult. We sent some speakers out, some real sharp guys. One guy from the Air Force Academy, really sharp, studied the material, and came back to me out of his first speaking engagement, asking me, he got blown out of the water. And he asked me all of these questions that I knew the answers to just like that, but it was only because I'd been involved with it for a long time. You have the opportunities here to immerse yourself, unfortunately, in this issue for a few more months than we did and get a little bit more knowledgeable so you can train some speakers. But I would suggest that you have some good qualified speakers that can do this and not just be your executive director and chairman of the board, because you're going to find yourself in a lot of trouble. The crucial turning point in the campaign were the PSAs that were donated. I believe that it was, that Focus had a lot at stake in what was going in our state. We make the statement in here that Focus may or may not be willing to help your states. That's on an individual basis. But because CFV was so physically close to Focus on the Family, and because Focus was moving into a state where the effect of this law was going to outcome them directly, they did some in-kind donations after that. After the petition drive, CFE printed 800,000 informational tabloids. You saw them when we picked them up in here. That was Mr. Olson's, one of his primary writings, and it was excellent. It's an excellent work. And we printed 800,000 of them and distributed somewhere around 750,000 of them. Now, we bought voter registration lists, and our area leaders around the state went basically door to door and knocked them down. All I know is that when we closed the campaign, we had 50,000 of these tabloids left over. 750,000 of them went out. Now, there were some sitting in people's garages. The most amount that anybody's ever called me and said that they had hanging around, somebody called me and had about 2,000 of them hanging around. But most of them, to my knowledge, were distributed. They got out to the public. That was a major effort, and it was very positive. And the news media and the opposition just lit up on those things. They hated him. Absolutely couldn't stand him. So everybody wanted to see him. News, this nasty newsletter! And everybody said, where? I want to see one. Everybody went looking for him. We said, gee. See if he developed 10 second TV slots. We edited those TV slots to, they were a lot of the parade video. At first we didn't think 10 second TV slots would be worth anything, but they turned out to be fairly well. They were fairly inexpensive and we could get some good information across on them. But we discovered that channels 2, 4, well actually, all the TV stations up in Denver wouldn't run them. Nobody would run them. The ones with the parades on there, and only a few of them would run our other ones where we just had some minority leaders talking about it. Okay. Well, had those TV ads run, I know we would have done better in Denver area. We might have won it, but that's hard to tell. But nevertheless, the publicity that we got when they refused to run them, it angered a lot of people, a lot of liberals, a lot of people that said, hey, no matter what, this isn't fair. This is not fair. And it became very clear that this was nothing but a purely censor. Matter of fact, later on, after the election, Maria Shriver ran a TV program and ran some of our ads uncensored. And they were nastier than the ones we ran uncensored. So they weren't worried about that. The homosexuals just had power centers inside those TV stations. And they did everything they could. They figured if they could stop us in Denver, they'd stop the state. But they didn't count on who our unseen partner was. Much of the campaign, I want to say, carried itself. The public seemed to catch the idea of special rights on their own. It really wasn't too hard of a sell on the public for the special rights. They pretty much understood that. All the legal mumble jumbo is kind of tough, and Tracy's going to talk about some of that, and we'll talk a little bit later on. But people pretty much understood that if you were gay, you still had civil rights, but you were asking for something unusual because you were gay. And all they needed was that intellectual reason for casting the yes vote on the ballot. The biggest struggle was getting the yes vote. See, most people, as soon as they see the word homosexual, they go, no. Homosexual, I don't care what it is, I don't want anything to do it. Well, we needed a yes vote. So it was difficult for us to get it out to people. We ended up kind of paraphrasing our language. It said, shall there be an amendment to prohibit protected class status for homosexuals? And when you put it that way, people said, oh, yeah, is that what that means? Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely, vote yes. Most people knew what they were voting for, but that was everybody tries to confuse those, especially the news media. This is so confusing, but it really wasn't as confusing as people were telling them. Everybody was telling them, you guys are confused, aren't you? No, I know what I'm doing. We got the yes vote. In closing, just whip through a couple of them, just on issues. CFE faced a large battle over home rule. In the city of Colorado, the homosexuals were trying to make bones about the fact that we were taking away home rule and removing the ability of local communities to make the decision on their own. I'm not going to go through the few thoughts on home rule, but primarily we were pretty much successful, we thought, at showing the hypocrisy in that. It's obvious at the federal level the homosexuals are trying to get laws and so on. This will kind of give you an idea later on. You can read it in your room or when you get home. But the home rule issue started out as kind of a big issue, but later on it kind of blew down. One of the biggest things that helped it blow down was after 247 and 9 wouldn't run our TV ads, there's a major talk show host in Denver named Mike Rosen, who understood the philosophical reasons to be for Amendment 2, that he wasn't going to vote for it based on the home rule issue. We sent him a number of these thoughts that we have in here, and Mike Rosen turned his mind over and decided that Amendment 2 wouldn't be an affront to home rule. And when he got on our side, he was on our side. And that really helped the home rule issue a whole lot. He went around saying, don't worry about it. The next big dot is that CFE chose no special rights for our campaign slogan. Yes, it was a campaign slogan. And we sure got nailed. People try to say, hey, you shouldn't choose a slogan. But slogans are designed to say in a couple words what your effort's all about. And that is, in fact, what this effort is all about. The No Special Rights campaign worked. And it drove the opposition nuts. It drove them nuts. They hate that word, but it doesn't matter. It works with the general public. And when you combine that with your other media stuff, it becomes pretty clear that special rights is what they want. I talked a little bit about the campaign. The opposition and the press continually tried to attempt manufacture leadership financial ties between CFE and Traditional Values Coalition and Christian Coalition and so on. I need to tell you, we would have no problem at all with admitting to a leadership and financial connection there if there was one. But the fact was there wasn't one there. And some of our supporters would call us and ask us, and we would say the truth is there is no financial or leadership connection there. CFE is run by local people, and our finances are almost all coming out of the state of Colorado. There was some from out of state, and everybody didn't have a problem there. But that was an issue that we faced, and it'll be an issue that you face. See, before, when they looked at us and said, you're part of a big nationwide campaign to do this, we'd say, no, we're not. We're just a bunch of local Colorado guys doing this. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending upon how you look at it now, there is a national movement coming out of this, and that's okay. That's okay. But we weren't at that time. The last dot says the general public is ignorant, for the most part, about on the subject of civil rights. That was a struggle for us, because the homosexuals have done a pretty effective job of making it seem like if you stand against protected status for homosexuals, you're standing against civil rights for everybody. Okay, I mean, they've done a pretty effective job of telling the people that. And that's basically because the general public's just kind of ignorant on what a protected status is and protected class status. And we went around the state teaching this seminar, and we're going to teach that to you, and it really cleared up in their minds. We kind of put it in layman's terms and helped them to understand what it meant. But the overall underlying thing was what eventually we want. That people did understand that you being, whatever your sexual preference is, has got nothing to do with the fact that you have constitutional civil rights. And that people were, in the end, able to make that division. But we fought that throughout the whole thing. And we had to convince voters, one, that there was a difference between constitutional rights and protected class status. And two, that there had to be some demonstrable need to get this protected class status. And we spent a lot of time working on that. That was the intellectual part. The press as an institution was nearly always on our opposition side. Now, we had individuals in the press that agreed with us, and some of them were out there. But as an institution, they were not. As a matter of fact, I think Will said that there was one editor of one of the papers that said that no other issue had caused so much consternation inside his paper than this one ever did. I mean, this thing really divides it, tears things up. But the press was pretty much against us. Those people in the beginning that started out giving us some good balanced reporting were quickly replaced. We had a couple guys, Dave Curtin down here and a couple other reporters that started out kind of on the homosexual side. Then they got to know us and their reporting came visibly balanced, and they replaced them and put some more people in there that would print a more balanced version of what it was all about. Our written essays and our brochures and the position paper were distributed to grassroots, and the philosophical model was put out to these folks. That's basically kind of putting it together. It's not a whole lot different than what you are doing in your area. Some things work, some things didn't work. The important part is that we didn't ever give up, and we just kept moving forward. And when we began to look back on how the Lord put us on the ballot, it became clear to us that we needed to keep on moving. The other thing I would say is this. My advice, especially to you executive directors, is plan like you're going to win. Make your plans, set your plans out in front of you like you're going to win. Because it's always better and always easier to close something down, to shut something down that's already moving, than it is to start something up from ground zero that you weren't prepared for. And quite frankly, CFV was not prepared as well as we could have been for our win. And we found ourselves stumbling and fumbling around in there trying to turn this thing around now from an organization that tried to win an initiative drive to an informational organization. Plan like you're going to win. Get things geared and things thought and get your positions lined up for like you're going to win the battle. And if you lose, then there's always other things you can do. But if you win, you're going to find yourself in a hole if you haven't made plans that you were going to win. And we weren't as well planned for our victory as we needed to be. We've got about 5 minutes worth of questions, and let's see if we can pull some in here. You had one. Michael was on the fundraising a while back. Yes, I believe it did. 40%. I'm got to say that for the tape recorder. But this thing wasn't won by a slick media campaign in the state of Colorado. those 10-second slots were effective, and I know one politician that used them pretty consistently, and they were pretty effective for her. But yeah, any campaign that you're running, everybody's looking for the swing voter. Everybody's got the people on the right and the left that's going to vote their way no matter what you do. Everybody's looking for the swing voter. So in that, from that standpoint, it's pretty much the same. You're trying to appeal that swing voter in the middle. The difference, though, I found is that you will be dealing with candidates. You can take a more pointed approach on your issue than a candidate will. A candidate's going to try and spread it out, kind of appease the people so that he or she doesn't offend anybody at all. As an issue campaign, you weren't worrying about offending people because you're not trying to get elected. What you're doing more than anything is trying to attach yourself, your rhetoric and your campaign to that swing voter's mind so that they can have the intellectual reason for voting the way that they already feel. But I didn't see it to be a whole lot different than running the campaign. You're going for that swing voter. You're going for that in-between voter that'll make or break your campaign. Every candidate, every issue goes for the same type of thing. Other than, I mean, it doesn't really matter to me if they accuse us of being stealth. They're going to accuse us of being Nazis and anything anyway. And who cares what they accuse us? I think we need to be careful that we're not running from straw men. Our opposition set up somebody. We try so hard to not be that person that we're ineffective. The point I was trying to make was that we didn't run a purposeful stealth campaign. We said, okay, now we're going to be real stealthily here. We're going to do all this stuff on purpose. And we did make some strategic thoughts on. But you would do that kind of in any campaign, not to let it out. Okay? But what we tried to do was run that. If you can run a good stealth campaign and it's effective, I would say do it. If you can run a good campaign that way. Here in Colorado, it wasn't a purposeful thing. Did you want to add something to that, Will? Basically, my thought would be run the campaign the best way you feel. Don't worry about what your opposition is going to accuse you of doing. If running it stealth is good, do it. The one thing you do need to keep in mind, though, is that the opposition is on to you now, as far as this issue goes. I mean, they're looking at states all over the place. They're waiting for these things to pop up. And the minute they get wind that there's possibly something happening, they're going to try and yank you out from underneath there. We kind of had the advantage of being the first one in the nation that was kind of doing it the way we were doing it. Our language was different. The whole approach was a lot different. And the whole thing marked. What some people would call stealth, I would call a real good grassroots campaign. And anything our opposition says, oh, that's stealth, we're going to say, well, we got 800,000 stealth people then, sorry. Right. We did. We carried a lot of those areas. I think for the benefit of this tape, I want to repeat a little bit what you said so people can go back. The point was we tried to pull the pastors out and make them come up front, and they wouldn't come up front. If the Lord had given us our way, we'd have made a mistake. But the Lord let it, you know, it happened the way He wanted it to happen, and it turned out better. So our advice to you when you go back to your states is deal with your pastors gently, give them the information and the ability to teach it, organize good at the grassroots level with your voters, and let the pastors and the churches keep a low profile and keep the targets down on there. And you'll see when you look at our packet back here, we didn't tell them, we just said, this is information on business, here's information on the military, here's him, because everybody has business people and military people in their church, and it gave everybody, it didn't tell them what to do. Let's see. Yes, sir. The voter turnout for the election was, well, total, we had about 1,000,006. 813. We had a very high voter turnout. It was up into the 80s. Because there's only about 1,000,006 total voters. Huh? 6,700 and something or other. At one time, we thought we'd try to get a 1-800 number. Mistake. As soon as they figured out we had a 1-800 number, we were getting all kinds of calls. They liked to ding up there. We didn't have too much problem with the homosexuals jamming our phone lines. As a matter of fact, we didn't have as much trouble with the homosexuals as you would think we would. We had our share of nasty phone calls and stuff. But one of the things that we did in the very beginning is we tried to do a campaign called No Room for Hatred. And it had two kind of parts to it. One part wasn't really compatible with what we were trying to do. But we held a couple press conferences where we talked about there would be no room for hatred. We had some of the state's leading civil rights attorneys sign a statement, put their signature on this statement that said that we would be agree on principled debate. And we basically said, we know that the homosexuals are likely ACT UP and Queer Nation do these kinds of stuff. So it's kind of like if they'd have pitched a brick through our window, we'd have went, see, just like we told you they were going to be. But they never really did that. Now, I got to tell you, the No Room for Hatred campaign got like zero to nil coverage in the press. We had three of the state's top civil rights leaders come out in favor of Amendment 2, and they got no press. I mean, no, the day we held that press conference, it was pitiful compared to some of the other press conferences we had. Some little old Baptist pastor in downtown Denver's got about 30 people in his church, comes out against Amendment 2, front page Denver Post. Okay, but these guys were civil rights leaders. But nevertheless, what might have happened is that there is a large contingent of pro-homosexual sympathizers in the newspapers. And I think it could well have been that we were making some statements like that, and we were saying, you know, if a rock gets pitched through our window, we're going to make sure you all know about it, because we're expecting it to happen. And we didn't get as much of it as you thought we would have. Our office is right downtown in the middle of where they all is. I mean, all the homosexuals in Colorado Springs are all, not all of them, but a lot of them, live right down in the downtown area, and our office is pretty close to it. And either they've decided that it's not to their benefit to bug us, or we've got some of the biggest, meanest angels standing outside of that building you've ever seen. And it might be both. Who knows? Ladies, we also kind of caught them flat-footed. They really didn't expect us to be here. When we won the petition drive, we caught them flat-footed, and the fact that we organized, they were kind of stumbling around. And there was a lot of infighting amongst themselves. You'll find that too, by the way. One of the things we prayed for specifically was confusion amongst the enemy. That when they sat down in their board meetings, they couldn't get 2 + 2 = 4 for nothing. It would be 9 and 16 and whatever else. That could also have been a large part of it. They didn't really expect us to be of anything. They spent a lot of time just trying to get themselves up to speed. There's one over here, but Paul had his hand. That's a very good question. Again, the answer to that question is no. Our campaign was not a sophisticated, politically sophisticated campaign. We didn't do any polling, either opposition polling or opinion polling. We didn't do any polling. We had a little bit of polling that was done that was kind of like ancillary polls that other people asked questions on their polls that were similar. We got some information. We didn't do any polling. We just took our message and just shotgunned it out there. Now, if we had to go back and do it again and we had the money, I know that we would try and do some of that sophisticated marketing, do a little bit more inner Denver. We were not successful in getting the African-American churches in the state on our side. I know there were individual pastors that were on our side that were, we had one of the legends in Denver, Reverend Leon Kelly, was on our advisory board. So that helped a lot. But to see them coming out was a little bit tough. But it wasn't a sophisticated campaign where we did demographic polls and found out what the makeup was and then targeted a particular thing right into that area. Well, although they took a poll, it was sent to me by, I think you sent it to me, Frank, where they took a poll in 1970, I think it was 1971, where they asked people, do you believe homosexuality between consenting adults is wrong? And it was like 37 to 45. 45 said yes, 37 said no, and they took the same poll in the early 80s, asked exactly the same question, and the figures were almost identical. 37% or so said no, it wasn't wrong, and 45 said no. Basically, the overall public opinion on the morality of homosexuality hasn't changed a whole lot. We're thought that we are, but it really hasn't flipped around a whole lot. Will? Mm-hmm. It's truth. I mean, you can actually, you know, teach him that. The other thing I found out is you show me a man or a woman that wants to serve the Lord, whether they're black, green, purple, or orange, and they're going to know the right stance on this. And most of the black pastors in downtown Denver, they knew the right stance. You know, they know what this thing is all, what this issue is all about from a spiritual standpoint, too. There are groups out there. As a matter of fact, Reverend Lou Sheldon is one gentleman, leader in the nation, who has really been effective at communicating this issue to especially the black community, and has a lot of African-American leaders that are speaking out on this issue in a right way. And he's an excellent resource for that. Jim. There's an organization out of New York, and I received their mailing two or three times. Huh? I think that's it. They really are on our side from a standpoint philosophically. They seem to have a good ear in the African-American community, and I bet they would be interested in being made a part of something like what we have going here today. I think there also has to be a balance between, I don't know, personally, I think we have to be careful in going after black leadership just because they're black leadership. We need them on our side because they're on our side, because they're men and women who know the truth and need the truth. But we need them here. But to go out and dig them up simply because they're black for a political motive, I believe, well, first of all, it's insincere, and they'll see it in a heartbeat, and they won't appreciate it any more than we would appreciate it. And secondly, we need to respect their ability to move within their community the way they want to move within their community, and not try to force what we think we need to do as politicals. Let me go to Steve first, because he's had his. Go ahead. You know, the other aspect of that is, liberals, I'm watching it here, dear, liberals are very willing to stand up and take the credit and say, I speak for the whole community. I mean, Jesse Jackson is very welcome to stand up as speaking for the black community, but he doesn't speak for the black community. What we found is we had some very strong Hispanic leaders that were on our side, but they know inside their heart they don't speak for the Hispanic community. And their conservative nature won't even allow them. They don't even want to stand up and speak for the Hispanic community. Now, they work real well within the Hispanic community, and I know that some of these folks in the southern part of the state were instrumental in the vote down there, and their name being attached helped in some of these areas like Pueblo and San Luis Valley that's predominantly Hispanic and normally vote Democrat. But we took those areas down there. But these people aren't willing to stand up like the liberals are and speak for their community. That's right. One of the things I think CFE's campaign did that was kind of good, because we didn't have a lot of money to do this sophisticated marketing, we didn't take anything for granted. We had some stuff pointed towards the military, towards the businesses. And it wasn't because we were, laying it all out on this political spreadsheet, but it because we didn't have the money or the time, the polling to do pinpoint marketing. So we talked about business in the holistic, umbrella type business, and we did all of it. And it seemed to be work. Most of the people out there, when given the facts, will be on our side, no matter what their color is. Thank you. That's a very important state. Absentee ballots and out of state. We had something happen in Colorado. For the first year, people were able to vote before the election time. Most people put all their money into the last week or two. Well, we had the first year where people out of state and absentee could vote up to 60 days before the actual election was held. And we found that large numbers of voters, maybe almost as much as 30% of the people, had already voted before the November 2nd election came around. That was scary. You need to look at that in your state and see what you can and cannot do and have an absentee. As a matter, it was interesting. I even wrote into the budget an absentee ballot mailer line item. And we thought about it in the beginning and we put it in the budget, but it just, I don't know, it got lost in the shuffle somewhere. We almost could have got hurt on that. Will and then Michael. Right. I don't think I could be wrong, but I don't believe our opposition was doing any absentee mailers either. I think it the whole thing got lost. And just a minute, Paul, let me get Mr. K.
I wanted to mention that that's very powerful.
First time this state had the opportunity to do that, and it caught everybody off guard. Candidates, everything. Everybody was. You don't have Paul Cameron as a resource, so you need to get him one, because he's great. One more question, and then we'll probably need to break up for lunch. Let's review the schedule. We will be back here at 12:45 sharp with the Olson. Mm-hmm. I think the one thing, and this is a shame, really, right now, it's not going to come out of Colorado for a while, and not from CFV if we want to, are the demographics of the vote. there's not a lot of studies right now on who voted what and how, you know, for your future states. There were some, but they weren't they weren't tabulated out by blacks. There was one, Tommy and Drake did some polling, exit polls, but they weren't tabulated out that way. How many of you are married? They did ask military people. They asked people, do you think gays should be allowed in the military? But they didn't ask how many of you are ex-military first. And that would have been a good crosstab to know how many of them were ex-military. You would have seen a difference in the polling there. But there are some good polls out there from other states. All we know is that here in Colorado, we did a shotgun approach, be it good or bad, and we won an election with it.